speaking boldly against the actions in Charlottesville, saying the Justice Department is coming after the white supremacists. Here's Chris Barnes.
We will not tolerate this kind of hatred and violence.
That's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who's speaking out about the violence sparked by a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia on Saturday.
We will not allow these extremist groups to obtain credibility. Morally, legally, they're unjustified in their actions and approach to American democracy.
Sessions says federal law enforcement agencies are assisting local and state police in Virginia, and the Justice Department and FBI have also launched a federal civil rights investigation into the deadly car attack. I'm Chris Barnes.
Former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci said he absolutely made mistakes before he was fired after 11 days in the role. Appearing on ABC's This Week, Scaramucci says he thought a taped phone call that ultimately led to his firing was off the record. USA Radio News.
Colonel Sanders from KFC here to talk about the good old days. Well, the good old days are still here in chicken form. Specifically, in KFC's original recipe fried chicken with 11 herbs and spices. Our delicious chicken is still hand-breaded and pressure-fried just like it was then. Get your fill with two pieces of my original recipe in a $5 fill-up with mashed potatoes, a biscuit, a cookie, and a drink at a KFC near you. KFC, it's still finger-licking good. At participating KFCs, prices may vary. Tax extra.
If you're one of the many who bought solar eclipse glasses from Amazon, you may want to pay attention to this next story.
The online retail giant is contacting shoppers who bought glasses that Amazon says may not comply with industry standards. Amazon is also taking down listings of some glasses out of an abundance of caution. Extremely dark sunglasses made specifically to view solar eclipses are necessary to avoid potentially permanent eye damage. Amazon is in the process of contacting people who bought glasses that could be unsafe.
The British landmark Big Ben is getting a makeover. Here's Chris Barnes.
Crews are making essential repairs to the clock and surrounding tower. The Great Bell has sounded on the hour for 157 years, though it was last silenced in 2007, and before that for major refurbishments between 1983 and 85. Parliamentary authorities say stopping Big Ben would protect workers carrying out the repairs. The big chimes will still sound for important events, though, like New Year's Eve and Remembrance Sunday. I'm Chris Barnes.
Energy drinks could be putting young adults at greater risk for alcoholism and drug abuse down the road. That's a warning coming from a study out of the University of Maryland, which looked at college students who regularly consume the drinks. It found by age 25, nearly 50% were more likely to use cocaine, stimulants, and develop an increased disposition toward alcoholism. The study was published in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence. USA Radio News.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County. Good afternoon. The weather today is going to be partly sunny with a high near 84. South winds around 6 miles an hour. Tonight, chance of showers, mainly between 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. It'll be mostly cloudy with a low around 66. South winds 3 to 5 miles an hour. And they say the chance of precipitation is 30%. Tuesday, slight chance of showers before 9 a.m., then a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Be mostly cloudy with a high near 82 with a light variable winds. Again, 20% chance of precipitation Tuesday. Tuesday night, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms before 9 p.m., patchy fog after 1 a.m., otherwise partly cloudy with a low around 64. Wednesday is a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 3 p.m., Patchy fog before 7 a.m., otherwise sunny with a high near 87. Calm winds becoming northwest, around 5 miles an hour in the afternoon. Wednesday night, guess what? A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms before 9 p.m. And it'll be mostly clear with a low around 64. The chance of precipitation is 20%. Thursday, Friday, the same thing, chance of showers, etc., etc. Good afternoon and welcome to NAMI's Hour, compliments of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'll get it right. I've only been doing it 20 years. But anyway, there is a chapter of NAMI in every county in the state of New Jersey, every state in the union, and overseas. In Hunterdon County, we are all volunteers. We work out of our houses, use our own phones, that sort of thing. And what we try to do is we try to help people who either have someone in their family who has a mental illness or someone themselves who have a mental illness. And we do this in various ways. We teach classes, family-to-family class, which is a 12-week course for families or some with either have a blood relative. And they don't have to have blood relatives. It can be your next-door neighbor, somebody you work with, or a friend of yours, or whatever. And we try to go over medications, side effects, etc., what to say, what not to say, what not to do in certain situations. And we try to get the person taking the class feel more what it's like to be the person with the illness. We also run a support group, and that is the third Thursday of every month, and that's from 7 to 9:30, and there's no registration. You have to register for the classes, but you don't have to register for the support group. We also have another class called Basics, which is for families who have younger children under the age of 18 who are suffering from, it could be a whole list of things, anxiety, depression, whatever. And all our classes and everything is free. And if you have any questions, you can call 908-354-5800. I said 5800. It's 5500. I'm sorry. It's 908-384-5500. And we don't man the phone 24/7, but there is somebody that checks it at least twice a day, and we promise we will get back to you. Today, we are very privileged to have with us Dr. Marla Deibler. And Dr. Deibler is a licensed clinical psychologist, and she's the founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, which is located in Cherry Hill, and also they have another office in Princeton. Dr. Deibler has been on Dr. Oz, A&E Hoarders, CBS, ABC, Fox News, and has had many articles in New York Times and other major newspapers. And it's truly a pleasure to have you back on the show, Dr. Deibler.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is always a privilege, believe me. You do a lot of good, and it's great to get the word out about what you do and all the people you help. I understand that your center specializes in anxiety disorders and obsessive compulsive, but they also have a number of related disorders. Would you take us through these disorders and their symptoms?
Sure. So in general, we specialize in the treatment of anxiety disorders, which are all characterized by worry in some capacity that's difficult to control that negatively impacts someone's life. So that can span generalized anxiety disorder, a phobia, panic disorder, agoraphobia, or other kinds of anxiety disorders like separation anxiety disorder, as well as obsessive compulsive spectrum disorders or obsessive compulsive and related disorders, which are related to anxiety, but a different family of disorders, which include obsessive-compulsive disorder, hoarding disorder, trichotillomania, excoriation disorder, and some related unspecified behaviors.
Okay. Now, when does everybody suffers anxiety at one point or another during their time on this earth? When does having anxiety become a problem for the person? I mean, like I said, if you, you get laid off your job, you get anxiety. You're having trouble with your girlfriend, you get anxiety. When does that become an actual disorder.
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point in that anxiety, very much like sadness or any other emotion, is just one of the normal kinds of emotions that people experience. And sometimes anxiety can even be helpful to us, right? I mean,
that's right.
Anxiety in moderation can help to motivate us. It's what gets us up in the morning. It's what helps us pay our bills on time or get to work on time or help motivate us to complete projects or help people. And so anxiety can be very helpful, but when anxiety is excessive, it can instead limit us or sometimes overwhelm us to the extent that it begins to impair our functioning. And so that's really when it becomes problematic, is when it leads to significant distress in our lives or limits our ability to function in some realm.
And, you know, having been with NAMI for about 20 years, I have seen, you know, people who have someone in their family or know someone who have anxiety, and it can be very earth-shattering to them. You know, it's not just, oh, gee, I'm breaking up with my girlfriend, you know, and, you know, it can be very traumatic for them.
Absolutely. I think, you know, mental health struggles get a bum rap in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I agree.
For some, it's stigmatized to the extent that people experience unnecessary shame and therefore don't seek treatment. But on the other side of the spectrum, there are certainly some disorders that are sort of undervalued in some way or mm-hmm. downplayed, like anxiety disorders, right?
Right.
That it's, not a big deal, that people are just, you know, they have a nervous habit or they're just anxious, they'll get over it. And it's really kind of unfair to the sufferer because it really is suffering. It really is difficult for folks to the extent that sometimes it really consumes them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And would you describe a little bit about obsessive-compulsive disorder?
Sure. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is a psychological disorder in which individuals experience obsessions, which are intrusive thoughts or images or urges or mental experiences that cause a great deal of distress, cause a great deal of anxiety, as well as compulsions. And compulsions are behaviors that are carried out or mental acts that are carried out repeatedly in order to decrease the distress. They're not enjoyable or pleasurable in any way, but they are instead a way for people to try to bring down their anxiety associated with the obsession.
Okay, and what would be an example of obsessive compulsive disorder?
So, for example, a common OCD theme might be contamination, right? We've probably often most of us have seen OCD kind of depicted this way on television. OCD can involve a lot of different kinds of symptoms,
mm-hmm.
but contamination is a pretty common symptom that people experience in which people get concerned about germs, right? So they're worried about contracting an illness or getting sick or perhaps even spreading that illness or those germs to other people. And so they experience a great deal of distress when confronted with a lot of different things that they might perceive as risky to getting contaminated or picking up germs. And so in an attempt to control the risk of perceived risk of picking up contamination or germs and to prevent the perceived feared outcome of getting sick or passing that illness or germs to other people, they then engage in compulsions, and some really common compulsions related to that kind of obsession are things like washing or sanitizing or showering or even avoiding, things that they see as contaminated.
And I know of someone who has a relative who has to go through a certain procedure before they go to bed. Like
for example, making sure the stove is off and the windows are all shut and the doors are locked. And if they go out of order, then they have to go back and start all over again and do it again. That would be obsessive compulsive, I would assume, correct?
Yes, that's a very common theme in obsessive compulsive disorder, and that would be a pretty common set of rituals. So people sometimes have intrusive thoughts about harm coming to themselves or to others unintentionally and being responsible for that harm. So they'll have intrusive thoughts like, if I don't make sure the stove is off, perhaps it will have been left on unintentionally and will cause a fire and will destroy the house and harm people, and that would be all my fault, mm-hmm. for example. And so they'll develop rituals surrounding checking to make sure to minimize what they perceive as potentially being dangerous.
We had some trouble just before we went on the air with some things, and I didn't mention the fact that the show is called Mental Health Matters, and I'm Larry Cartwright, the host, and my co-host is Tracy Ivey, who's sitting here.
Hi.
And shaking her head at me like, you know,
no,
you screwed up again.
No, I'm not.
But hey, I'm used to it, so it's
here
no
we
big
are.
Deal. Yeah, you know. And as I said earlier, we have Dr. Marla Deibler with us, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and founder and executive director of the Center for Emotional Health of Greater Philadelphia, which is located in Cherry Hill and also in Princeton. Now, Princeton is fairly new now, correct?
We've been in Princeton for about, I would say, 4 years or so now.
Okay. All right. Well, compared to the other one, it's new, right, to the one in
right.
Cherry Hill.
Okay. Yeah, we've been in Cherry Hill for 9.
Okay, so, you know. Now, you had mentioned earlier when I asked you to explain some of these things, you spoke about body-focused repetitive behaviors, hair pulling, nail biting, skin picking. Now, I know they have medical names, which you said, which I won't try to pronounce, but... what is it? Trichotillomania? Is that
right? Very good. Trichotillomania.
Hey, I said
it. Hair pulling disorder.
It's hair pulling, right?
And excoriation disorder is a
skin picking
disorder.
Now, when people do that, is it because that the pain they get from their pulling their hair or skin picking is a diversion from what is going on in their head?
Not typically.
Okay.
Body-focused repetitive behaviors are behaviors that are carried out, and typically they're grooming behaviors, like scratching or pulling or picking of the hair, skin, or nails that unintentionally causes damage to the body. People who engage in these behaviors have attempted a number of times, typically, to stop the behavior. They find it distressing. But at the same time, there are a number of factors that influence the maintenance of the behavior. So the behaviors typically serve a function, but that function can be different for different people. So for some people, it might be carried out to, for example, help them to kind of self-regulate their own emotions. So they might engage in the behavior when they are overstimulated and need to kind of self-soothe, or they might engage in the behavior when they're kind of understimulated and they need to kind of fidget. But there are a lot of different potential factors that can be involved in maintaining the behavior. And really, you know, as with any psychiatric disorder, there are typically many different factors
right.
that are important for why the individual is struggling with this. There is typically learning involved in behaviors, but you know, there's also genetics and there are other biological factors, and these things are complicated.
Yeah, and you know, they are. That's why I think centers like what you were what you founded and are running are so helpful to people who have these disorders. You know, it gives them some place where they can get help, you know.
I have a question, Larry. Dr. Deibler.
Adler. If someone is doing nail biting or hair pulling or something like that, is that usually just only one of their symptoms? Would they ever just be that be the only thing that they're doing?
That's a great question. Sometimes, and sometimes not. There are plenty of people who struggle with a body-focused repetitive behavior, like nail biting is a really common one, that don't seem to have any other kind of identifiable struggle. They'll deny problems with anxiety or depression, or and they don't really seem to have any significant stressors beyond that that, you know, that the average person out on the street who's not struggling with it experience. But as with any other psychological problem, when someone has one diagnosis, they tend to be more likely to have another diagnosis compared to people who don't struggle at all, you know, beyond the normal range with psychological factors.
Yes,
and so people are more likely to have a co-occurring disorder like anxiety or depression.
Right. And I was trying to think of an example of someone at work who maybe was what would cause them to go to a clinic that would it would probably be interfering with their job. I mean,
it could be, or sometimes not. I mean, we see plenty of people who struggle with hair pulling or skin picking or sometimes even nail biting. And, you know, it's just this thing that affects them and their own sense of self and their confidence and, you know, their ability to feel good about the way that they look, about the way that they feel, but doesn't necessarily impact their functioning in terms of their job performance or their ability to be a parent or, you know, any significant realm of functioning in terms of their ability to complete daily activities.
Right. So even though it's minor, they might still go to a clinic like yours to seek help because it bothers them enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Or, you know, there are also not just psychological sequelae. I mean, sometimes there are physical effects of these problems. For example, we all know people who bite their nails. Nail biting is probably the most common of these kinds of behaviors. And when we see a nail biter, we don't necessarily think that's a mental illness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we see a nail biter, we can probably safely assume that they're not likely, if that's all they're struggling with, to present to mental health professionals. However, occasionally we do see folks who struggle with nail biting who want to stop because, one, they're frustrated by it. They think it's unsightly. They don't like the way it looks. But also, folks that bite their nails down really low or bite the cuticles often have recurrent infections, and that's
right.
Painful and requires a lot of recurrent medical treatment, and sometimes there's scarring. And so sometimes people report for treatment just because of those factors. It's not necessarily that they're struggling psychologically, but that they have you know, physical effects of the behavior that they want to get under control.
Okay, thank you.
Would cutting fall within this spectrum?
Cutting is not considered part of this spectrum. Cutting behavior we put in a group of behaviors that we term self-injurious behaviors. And self-injurious behaviors also serve a function. Typically, they're not the same function as individuals who engage in BFRBs. Typically, the kind of function that cutting behaviors serve is goal-directed. People tend to want to engage in cutting behavior. And people who engage in BFRBs, they tend to want to stop the behavior, but they have trouble stopping the behavior. So there's different motivational factors, and it typically serves a very different function. Individuals with self-injurious behaviors tend to have significantly more co-occurring psychological struggles. So it's much more highly co-occurring with problems like depression or personality disorders or, you know, other kinds of psychological problems that require treatment.
The reason I ask is because I have said this a couple times over the last couple of years on the radio that I used to do about 5-6 hours a week on a Saturday at the Huntington Medical Center in emergency services. And there's a section of the hospital they call 2 Central where it's, you know, it's locked, but it's, you know, patients are in there for various reasons. And I would go there and talk to them. And one day this fellow, young man, He says, can I talk to you outside? I said, sure. So we went outside, and we were talking. And he says, I got to show you something. Well, he rolled up his sleeves to his shoulder on both sides, both arms, and there wasn't a piece of skin that wasn't scarred, that wasn't cut or, you know. And I didn't know what to say. I was, and that's unusual. Anybody who knows me know I don't get a loss for words. But I was just shocked. And we got to talking, and I find out that, like you said, he had, you know, he suffered from depression, and his thing was he would cut himself because the pain, when he cut himself, took away the pain, he said, in his head. And I just, I mean, you know, I've heard of people cutting themselves and such, and seen a couple that have, but never to this extent, you know. And hopefully I recommended some things for him to do, and, you know, at the hospital there while he was confined. And hopefully they followed up on it, but it was just, you know, it was more than I could handle. You know what I mean? It was like beyond my belief that anybody would do this to themselves, you know, to that extent. But anyway, that's why I asked if it would fall within that spectrum or not, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the important potentially shared factor is the idea that sometimes people struggle with emotion dysregulation, right? They need some help learning to better regulate their emotions, and treatment is really helpful for that. For self-injurious behaviors, we have a pretty well-developed evidence-based treatment called dialectical behavior therapy that can help people learn to better tolerate distress and learn alternatives to resorting to the kind of behavior in order to regulate their own internal discomfort.
Yeah, it's...
Could you maybe outline briefly what that might cover, and whether that happens in several sessions or one sessions, the dialectical behavior therapy?
Sure. So dialectical behavior therapy is often referred to as DBT, and DBT is a kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. Typically, it's a very comprehensive, involved a number of different kinds of service. For example, it involves individual therapy. It also involves group therapy. It involves treatment teams and consultation within the treatment team. And typically the programs that do it are specialized programs that do dialectical behavior therapy. And dialectical behavior therapy essentially involves four main components of treatment. One of it is mindfulness training. Another is distress tolerance training to help people to become more able to tolerate internal distress. There's emotion regulation training also, and also interpersonal effectiveness, helping people to better navigate interpersonal relationships, because it's often interpersonal relationships that lead to distress, that lead to distolerance, that lead to self-injurious behavior. And so DBT programs are typically pretty involved, because it takes some time to develop better ways of coping with that internal discomfort.
So you might ask someone who's having a problem to make a list of some coping behaviors that would help them. Would that be an example?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very involved program. Okay. I'm not trained in DBT, so I'm not a good resource in terms of defining all the different kinds of components within those areas of treatment, but typically it's a very involved way of helping people to understand a lot of different strategies that can be employed. And there's also a lot of limit setting to help individuals learn new patterns of behavior so that they don't resort to the really problematic behavior patterns that they've fallen into, such as cutting or other kinds of acting out.
Doctor, would tic disorder and Tourette's fall under any of these categories?
So tic disorders and Tourette's, which is a complex tic disorder, it falls under a different kind of category called neurodevelopmental disorders. And they're essentially disorders of childhood because they develop in childhood.
Okay.
And tics typically show up between the ages of 7 and 10, and sometimes they're transient. But other times they're not transient, and they, you know, might require some more in-depth treatment. But they're technically neurodevelopmental disorders.
Okay, and Tourette's is what exactly?
Tourette's disorder is a disorder in which an individual experiences both vocal tics and motor tics.
Okay.
Throughout the course of time at the same time.
Okay. Okay. Do you in your clinics use cognitive behavior therapy? I can speak, I said. Cognitive behavior therapy? And if so,
right.
What's it used
yeah.
for?
Yeah, so cognitive behavioral therapy is, if you want to think about it as sort of a family of evidence-based treatments that focus on the foundation of learning theory, that behavior is carried out and maintained by a set of circumstances, that there is an antecedent that makes that contributes to a behavior and a consequence that results that either reinforces the behavior or doesn't reinforce the behavior, and that cognitive behavioral therapy involves helping to people to understand the way that they think, the way that they feel, and the way that they choose to behave, and how all that relates to one another in either a functional or a dysfunctional way in terms of patterns of thinking, feeling, and acting.
Okay. I know that you were on the Hoarder show, not because you were, not that you hoarded, but you were on as a advisor type thing. And would you speak to hoarding a little bit? Is that because someone hoards, are they, you know, do they have a problem?
So hoarding is a specific disorder that involves difficulty with the acquisition of items that clutter a living space that then renders that space unable to be used in the manner in which it was intended because there's too much stuff, essentially. And it significantly impairs the person's functioning because there are so many things that it becomes difficult to use the space, or it's difficult for them to be able to carry out their daily activities because of the lack of room to move or room to use their homes.
So if someone had a bunch of stuff up in the attic, that wouldn't necessarily be considered hoarding, would it?
No.
I've heard of
no,
people...
because it doesn't have a negative impact on their functioning.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah. So I guess on the show, they sometimes feature people who they just have a tiny little channel through a room where they can walk because the entire rest of the room is just filled with stuff from years and years and years ago.
Or stuff that they buy all the time. You know, I know someone whose daughter is that way, and you know, she barely can walk in the apartment because it's, like you said, a narrow path through all this stuff, you know, and, you know, it's sad, you know, because not only are they, a lot of times they're spending their money on this stuff that they're never using, but they're also, you know, not having any place to live or carry out their life, you know.
Was this only...
Yeah, it's a complex struggle, and it really results in quite a bit of isolation and shame and
right.
Quite difficult.
Now, do you use, and if you do, would you explain it, and who you treat with it, exposure and response prevention?
So exposure and response prevention is a type of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's very much evidence-based that helps individuals with anxiety disorders, exposure therapy. Exposure and response prevention specifically is used also for obsessive compulsive disorder. And what it essentially is it's a way of helping patients to face their fears, essentially, so that their minds and bodies become accustomed to those things to extinguish the fear response.
Okay. Let's say someone, you know, reaches out to your organization, or the doctor recommends that they, you know, reach out to you and your group. What is the procedure for that then?
So, when someone is interested in assistance, what we recommend is that they call the intake coordinator. And the intake coordinator will ask some questions about what they're seeking help for and what their preferences are in terms of treatment, whether they're comfortable with a male doctor or a female doctor, what their needs are in terms of location, and then they're set up for an initial evaluation with one of our clinicians, and that clinician meets with them and does a thorough clinical interview to determine what the presenting problem is and collaboratively discuss how to best address that in terms of treatment planning, and then they are set up for treatment.
So are this do you have both inpatient and outpatient?
We don't have inpatient.
Okay.
We have outpatient only, although we sometimes do intensive outpatient.
Okay. Is there like, you know, when the patient... Is there like, do they have a case manager who guides them through these procedures, or how does that work?
No, we don't have a case manager. We try to very closely match people to a therapist that's most closely suited to their needs. So the clinician that gets assigned to them will then be the person who is responsible for their care. And so not only will they deliver treatment, but if they need assistance in terms of consultation with their school or coordination with other treatment providers like psychiatrists or primary care physicians, that's also the responsibility of that clinician.
Okay. Do you get many students as opposed to older adults or adults?
Yeah, as patients? Yeah.
Yes, as patients.
Yes, yes. It ranges. So we see kids as young as 4 or 5 into, you know, older adulthood. And we're pretty evenly distributed in terms of the kinds of clients that we see. It's a little bit different for us based on our locations. In our Princeton office, we tend to get more college-age students because our office is right across the street from the university.
Okay.
And so we tend to see a lot of students there.
Get a lot of walk-ins, right?
Yeah, lots of. We get a lot of students from the area in Princeton, but that's really, you know, just due to our location.
When you talked about intensive outpatient, are you talking more like a day program from 9 to 3, or what did you mean by that?
So a program that is like from 9 to 3, we refer to that as partial hospitalization. So there are programs, usually hospital-based programs, that offer those kinds of programs that are 3 or 5 days a week for part of the day. And there's specific programming throughout the day, like group therapy or individual therapy or recreational therapy or other kinds of activities, whereas intensive outpatient is usually like an hour and a half back-to-back, so 2 back-to-back sessions, in other words, for an hour and a half, once, twice, or 3 times a week, which is generally individual therapy carried out just more frequently throughout the week.
Okay.
So sometimes people require that because of the just need for that level of care, and other times we're just trying to give them some intensive treatment so they can get back to life. So, for example, if someone is having very significant trouble over the summer and they're going back to school in a month, we might do intensive treatment for 4 weeks to see them 3 times a week so that hopefully we can decrease their distress, increase their ability to function, to get them back into their life and be able to start school.
Okay. Thank you. Makes sense.
Is there an average length of time for a person's treatment, or does it depend on the individual and their problems?
Length of treatment is really individually based. It's really dependent on the person. Cognitive behavioral therapy in general is meant to be a shorter-term therapy. There are certainly people that we sometimes see for perhaps 8 weeks that do quite well, 8 to 12 weeks, if it's something simple, and maybe it's an exposure-based therapy, or maybe it's habit reversal training, or something very behavioral, parent training, that we can do in a short period of time with a patient who's able and willing to follow through with what we do in therapy between sessions. They might be done in 8 to 12 weeks. For some people, it takes longer because they're perhaps the depth of the problem or the breadth of the problem is more significant, or perhaps it's more severe in general, or perhaps they have more than one problem they're dealing with, and so sometimes the treatment plan's a little more complicated. So it depends on the person.
Okay. You mentioned habit reversal. What is that?
Habit reversal training, or sometimes we refer to it as the comprehensive behavioral model, is a behavioral treatment that helps individuals change difficult, unwanted behaviors, such as those body-focused repetitive behaviors.
Okay. And mindfulness training?
Mindfulness training is a component of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a sometimes people use it as a standalone in terms of trying to help people to learn to be more present focused rather than worrying about the past or the future, but more to help them kind of center and learn to be more aware of their current experience in their bodies in this place and this time. And then other times it's used as part of a more comprehensive program like dialectical behavior therapy or like acceptance and commitment therapy, in which it's a piece of the puzzle.
Okay. There is acceptance and commitment therapy, or the acronym ACT. Do you use that, or, and if you do, what is that procedure?
Yes. So acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT exactly, is a kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a newer cognitive behavioral therapy. It's also evidence-based. And the goal of ACT really is to help people learn to better tolerate the experience of their inner world. From time to time, we experience uncomfortable thoughts, feelings, images, sensation, memories that kind of show up inside us from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And ACT helps people to more openly experience those experiences, to be willing to experience the range of inner experiences that we have as people, and to live a life that is flexible and consistent with the kinds of people that we want to be and the kinds of values that we hold.
Disorders, or are they specialized, or?
No, we're a specialized center, so both of our locations focus on providing these kinds of therapies for anxiety disorders and obsessive compulsive and related mm-hmm. disorders. We also treat ADHD and some neurodevelopmental disorders like tic disorders, and provide psychological evaluations and psychoeducational evaluations. So we do some other things as well, but both locations have psychologists who are particularly skilled in those areas.
Okay. What is the what's the average number of patients for each one? Is one bigger than the other, or?
Yeah, they're a little different. So okay. Cherry Hill is our kind of flagship main location. And here in Cherry Hill, we have typically 7 clinicians here at a time working in 7 offices. And then in Princeton, we're half that size. We have 3 offices in Princeton.
Okay.
Doctor, can we get a little bit more into ADHD? Are you treating, number one, are you treating both children and adults? And number two, what are some of the current treatments? Is this viewed as curable?
So ADHD is also a neurodevelopmental disorder that does exist in both kids and adults. The approach these days really is to assess the impact on the individual's functioning. So in what ways do these deficits impact one's ability to carry out their daily responsibilities, whether it's home responsibilities or work responsibilities or school responsibilities? So part of it is to not only evaluate symptoms, but also the impact of these difficulties on their functioning and their responsibilities. And then treatments in terms of improvement, the data on treatments is kind of mixed in that medications can be helpful. Stimulant medications or non-stimulant medications can be helpful for individuals to help with sustained attention. And so sometimes we do refer for medications, and sometimes that's helpful for individuals. In terms of the kind of treatment we provide is we help individuals to learn compensatory strategies and to help them with an evidence-based treatment that is called organizational skills training, to essentially help them to learn the skills necessary to employ better organizational skills so that they can sort of compensate for some of the difficulties they have with attention and focus. And so organizational skills training can be helpful for those individuals, whether they're kids or whether they're adults, to learn some strategies that may be vital for them in order to minimize the impact on their lives. But in terms of, is it curable? No, it's not something that we can kind of cure. You know, our brains are all slightly different from one another, and we all have our strengths and weaknesses. And so with ADHD, we're talking about executive functioning, the ability of our frontal lobe to carry out attention and planning and organizational kinds of tasks. And for people who struggle with that, we help them to learn procedures that can help kind of compensate for that so that it minimizes the impact on their lives.
Okay, now I have sometimes heard that ADHD in children is actually bipolar disorder or can lead to bipolar disorder. Do you have any comment on that?
No, there's no relationship between the two in terms of one leading to the other. They're distinctly different disorders.
Okay.
One is an executive functioning problem that involves problems with attention and planning and initiation and organization and impulsivity. And the other is a mood regulation problem that is sometimes associated with behavioral problems as well.
Okay. Great.
Why don't you, doctor, if you would, give a phone number or,
website.
Website. There you go. I couldn't think of a word. I'll tell you, getting old is terrible. If anybody needs to look up, your website or wants to get a hold of, your organization, if you'd give the phone number, that'd be great.
Sure. We have one office that does the intake. So there's one phone number for either location. It's 856-220-9672. That's 856-220-9672. And our website is centerforemotionalhealth.com.
Could you repeat that? It's center singular or centers?
It's singular, the centerforemotionalhealth.com.
Okay.
Written out that long, just like that.
Okay. So the in the beginning. Okay.
Exactly.
Got it. The Center for Emotional Health.com. And do you take Medicare or Medicaid and any insurance?
That's a good question. We opt out of Medicaid and Medicare, so we're not Medicare and Medicaid providers. That being said, we sometimes do see Medicare and Medicaid patients, and you know we can help try to accommodate people in terms of fee adjustments to help make it more feasible for them. We do have variable rates in terms of our rates. We do take some insurance. We take Aetna, and Aetna's affiliated insurance companies who purchase the Aetna network. There are a bunch of them, like CoreSource and Nippon and Assurant and Alliant. There's a lot of different small companies that buy the Aetna network.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, sometimes people decide to submit claims for reimbursement. Most people have out-of-network coverage, and so sometimes people decide to submit claims for reimbursement. We have different levels of providers here, so we have a tiered fee system. So we have licensed psychologists who have a set fee structure, and then we have postdoctoral fellows who are under the supervision of licensed psychologists. They have a separate fee structure that's a little bit lower than the licensed psychologist. We also have a licensed clinical social worker who has a fee structure, and then we have students who are in doctoral programs who are learning from the licensed psychologists who have another fee structure.
Well, Doctor, it's been a pleasure. We've got about 2 minutes left. Is there anything that you wanted to touch on that we didn't touch on?
I think also I'd love to just add that the importance not only of accessing the kind of care that people need, I think, is important. But beyond that, support. Support is so very necessary. Support groups can be really helpful for families who are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting to nonprofits or advocacy groups like NAMI are really great in terms of being full of resources and connecting people to resources in their area. And so I think that people should be aware of the other avenues to gain support as well, other than treatment.
Right. And I think that from my limited experience over the years, it's so much better for the person to have support of family and et cetera to get them through some of their tough times than those who have no one, you know. And I'm sure you find that true too, you know.
Absolutely. Struggling with mental health can feel so isolating and so stigmatizing.
Right.
And yet it's so common, and it's so important for people to have support so that they feel like they're not alone and that there is help.
That's true. Doctor, if you could give the phone number one more time, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. We're at 856-220-9672.
Okay, and the website was?
TheCenterForEmotionalHealth.com.
Okay, TheCenterForEmotionalHealth.com. Dr. Deibler, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It is always a pleasure to speak to you, and I really appreciate all the work that you and your staff and people are doing. There's so many people out there that need help, and, you know, we're putting a dent in it, you know, and hopefully, you know, we get more and more people to deal with their problems or get help dealing with their problems by organizations such as yourself.
Thank you for having me. Thank you both. And thank you for all you do, because every bit of awareness that we can put out there for folks, you know, connects people with the help they so desperately need.
That's true. Dr. Marla Deibler, it has been a pleasure as usual, and I will get a hold of you again, and we can do this again sometime down the road.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yes.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
We'll see you all next week. Remember, folks, mental health does matter. We'll see you same time, same station next week.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness?
NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
This is Tony Clark, Para Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon. Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. This is Chamber President Chris Phelan inviting you to the 29th Annual Business and Home Expo with our Restaurant Showcase. This wonderful event will happen on Thursday, November 9th at our new location, Next Level Arena on Case Boulevard in Flemington from 2 to 7 p.m. If you're a business or organization and would like to participate, contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at hunterdonchamber.org.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime, and selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process food technologies to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a